All right, I have a quiz for you, Greg Wyshynski.
Okay.
In the spirit of these are a few of my favorite things.
Okay.
Do you know what one of my favorite things is in hockey? Specifically on hockey television, on hockey broadcast.
All right.
Do you know what one of my favorite things is?
Go ahead.
When one of my dear friends, one who, when I first met, was a snide, smack-talking, smart aleck blogger, suddenly appears on a very mainstream broadcast wearing a suit and a tie, and considering he's broadcasting into Canada, wait for it, a puppy.
Oh.
It always warms my heart when I see Greg Wyshynski get drawn and sucked into the clutches as the claws go deep into the bone of mainstream media.
I thought this was going to be about Steve Dangle, so I'm a little disappointed.
No, this one's about you, but it's nice seeing you out with Murphy yesterday.
I did Sportsnet last night. I was on with the lovely and talented Sportsnet Murph.
Yep,
and,
Dan Murphy.
And it was interesting because I actually had a little butterflies in my tumbly last night about going on because I knew that I was going to be on a broadcast that a lot of Vancouver fans were going to watch. I'm not the most beloved person in Vancouver, especially that I felt the Kadri non-suspension was the right call from the moment that the play happened. I'll pat myself in the back for that. So I thought that there might be some consternation or concern that maybe that they would come at me hard to serve the audience. But it wound up being a very cordial time, I felt.
Yeah, I mean, I know that I think Murph disagrees with it specifically, the non-suspension. Murph's going to be joining us here in a couple of moments towards the bottom of the hour.
So maybe he'll give it to me both barrels.
That he's the guest, right? Because before he was in the position of interviewer, now he's going to be the guest. So he can just absolutely let you have it right between the lookers. You know what I found about this one? That, and I don't know whether it's a comment on fans becoming more sane in Vancouver, fans sort of mellowing out a little bit in Vancouver, or there just being less of them. I found that when I went on to defend the hit or defend the Department of Player Safety's ruling that there shouldn't be supplemental on this one, I mean, there's a token Vancouver fan that's, I'm unfollowing you. You're an effing blah, blah, blah. You get that. It's going to happen. But I didn't find that there were very many of them this time, at least not on my feed.
Oh, yeah?
Did you get it?
Oh, of course I got it. But, I mean, you know. But that's more of an ingrained thing. Like I had somebody email me about the Kadri hit, and they said to me, I am no longer going to read or listen to anything that you do, and I won't be buying your book. I replied, the book's been out for a year. Chances are you weren't going to buy it anyway if you haven't already. But, you know, I got a few of those. But, I mean, that's more of an ingrained, like, you've been a dick to Vancouver thing than anything else. But, no, what I found interesting about this one, besides the fact that no one seems to have realized that the word blindside no longer appears in the rule book, it doesn't. What I found interesting about this one is the idea that even though he was suspended twice in the last 2 years for four games apiece in those suspensions, there was a notion that Nazem Kadri is being defended by the league or somehow getting favorable status because he's a Leaf. I think they would have suspended his ass in a millisecond had they had just cause to. And by that I mean if the head had been the principal point of contact, which I don't think it was, but let's say it was, you got to have video to prove it, and they don't have video to prove it. And everybody was on the Vancouver side of the ledger, a lot of people bringing up the Virtanen hit, where you got the two-game suspension for it.
Like,
the video evidence there is clear. The video evidence on the Rafi Torres hit on Jared Staal was clear. The video evidence on David Pastrnak jumping into a guy trying to catch a puck in the air was pretty clear. On this one, the best available angle that you had was with Sedin's back to the camera. And there you couldn't tell what the hell was going on. So I don't think they're protecting Kadri. They've shown no desire to protect Kadri in the past. It's just that I don't think they could suspend him, one, because the rule book was changed, and two, because they didn't have the video evidence to warrant it.
Here's the other thing that I will go to bat for with the Department of Player Safety, specifically under Stefan Quintal, is they have been consistent with one thing all along in this regime. A player's reputation and a player's past can make a suspension longer, but it can't turn a non-suspension into a suspension. It can't take a borderline play. You can't take that and say, well, because he's been suspended before, we're not going to give him the benefit of the doubt, and ding, we're going to hammer him. No, it can't turn a non-suspension into a suspension, but it can lengthen one. And that's something we always need to keep in the front of our mind. This is an administration that will not do that.
It won't, but that's where I have a little bit of a problem with it. Because
I got none. I got none.
I know essentially.
Are you breaking a rule or not?
No,
and even
I get
if you're
you.
Close.
I think at the end of the day they make the right call on that, because if we all are screaming about consistency, that's the only way you're going to get consistency, is to not just suspend to the reputation. But yeah. I will say this, in defense of people that want to see that happen. The original plank in the platform on which the Department of Player Safety was built under Brendan Shanahan was there is a select group of people in this league that are the repeat offenders, that are the ones that keep doing these things, and our job is to change their behavior or take them off the ice. And, I mean, Nazem Kadri is a dirty player. I don't think that there can be any debate about that when you see 2 4-game suspensions in 2 years, and this one, which was right on the borderline. It was very close to being a suspension. Very close. So if someone said, don't give him the benefit of the doubt, based on the foundation on which this department was built, I can see their point. But at the end of the day, I agree with you, Merrick, which is that if you want consistency and that's the thing you want, and that's the thing we all want out of the Department of Player Safety, you can't ask them to ignore the rule book, ignore the evidence, and then just go after a guy because he's that guy.
Or you go on feeling. Because my first thought when I first saw the hit and I'm watching the game live, my first thought was, oh, man, that's a bad hit.
Yeah, because his head snaps back. He loses his bucket. His head bounces off the ice.
I'm like, oh, we're looking at 5-10 for that one. Oh, and you get used to life without Nazem Kadri, Toronto Maple Leafs. But then when you break it down, you say, oh, okay, it is. The primary point of contact is shoulder. It's a body hit. It goes through the body, and the head is a secondary area of contact. It is not a direct shot to the head. My initial thought is, it's a bad one. But then it's one of those hits that optically it looks bad, but you can't suspend for optics. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and then there's a lot of, well, that's not really the spirit of the rule, and they should suspend for the spirit of the rule. Well, no, you can't suspend for the spirit of the rule, right? There's a rule book, and it is cut and dry. Now, if you don't like that hit, then your issue is not with the Department of Player Safety. They don't make the rule books. They just enforce it.
Right.
If you don't like that, then lobby to have that rule changed.
Right.
But be mindful that it's only a problem when it's your bull that gets gored. Because there are players on that Vancouver team that will make that exact same hit.
Yeah.
And we all know who they are. Let's just remember how you felt about Nazem Kadri, because a player on your team will do the same thing eventually.
Right.
It happens.
True. Jacob Trouba signs a 2-year deal worth $6 million, a little bridge contract action. Everybody kind of saw this coming down the pike because of...
Where's that bridge go to, by the way?
Does it go to
another contract with Winnipeg, or does that bridge go to Detroit or Pittsburgh or Boston or New Jersey?
That bridge looks exactly like the bridge that Kyle Turris built in Arizona with the Coyotes.
Yes.
Same agent,
yes.
Same deal. Wanted out, signed a bridge deal instead. Where does the bridge go? I think the bridge goes to the expansion draft. And I think at the around the expansion draft, we are going to see an unprecedented amount of player movement as teams reconfigure their rosters and try to figure out how to handle life when you think you're going to lose a dude. And I think during that time, we might see a move around the draft. I don't think he comes back to Winnipeg next year.
You don't see it happening sooner?
No.
With a right-hand shot defenseman that can, at worst case, play second pairing?
No, because I think Cheveldayoff, I believe it when he says this, because, I mean, he can do it, especially now that he's under contract. He ain't trading them until he gets what he wants. So if somebody wants to...
Oh, but that's what
I'm
saying. You don't think someone will give him what he wants?
No. Wait, why would they do it now when they haven't done it before? Because he's on a bridge deal?
Because he's he's just left $4 million on the table. Okay. So you're a team around the NHL that says to yourself, hang on, I can get him for the remainder of this year plus next year, and I'm saving $4 million. I'm getting this player who has devalued himself, and I'm being kind here, who has devalued himself over these 2 years by at least $4 million. $4 million that aren't coming back. I can get him for that?
I think
like if you traded for him before, okay, then we're looking at probably something like the Ristolainen, the Lindholm, the Morgan Riley 5.5 area. And hang on a second, I can get him at 3?
I think that's
Are you
a fair
serious.
I think it's
I
a fair point.
I got him for 2 years.
I think it's a fair point. So you're saying that teams that would have been reticent to give up the kind of defenseman that Cheveldayoff's asking for in this deal will do
yes,
it now because Trouba's on,
totally.
On a lower ticket.
That's it. Like to me, it looks like this. Okay, look, Jacob, this is untenable right now. You want to move? I need to get the most I can for you, and the only way that's going to work is if you come in at a cheap price. Well, how cheap are we talking here, Chevy? $3 million a year. Oh man, I can't leave $4 million on the table. How bad do you want to get out of here?
Yeah.
Like, have you? Yeah. When's the last time? And have we ever seen a player sign a "get me the f out of here" contract? Because Jacob Trouba just did.
Well, not since Tourist. You know. No, I agree with you. I think you make a good point, but at the end of the day, it's still whether you're willing to give up the young defenseman that Winnipeg wants in return for their young defenseman.
Yep.
And it comes down to whether or not you think Jacob Trouba is better than that defenseman you're going to have to give up.
Listen, I think Jacob Trouba is better than the second pairing right-hand shot D they have right now in Tyler Myers. So right from the hop, I thought that if it's a matter of, you know,
he's shorter
positioning, I'll take he is well, mini R. I'll take Jacob Trouba as a second pairing D over Tyler Myers. But still, regardless, that's their decision and that's how they have it structured. But they very much want a left shot defenseman right now.
Yeah,
which is weird. Wow, my kingdom for left shot defenseman. There's a bajillion of them around. it'll be an interesting deal. Like I think it happens sooner. Because all of a sudden now, you pick up Trouba, sure it costs you a prospect, good young hockey player, but you're saving $4 million 2 years. That's mm-hmm. what he's left on the table here. Mm-hmm. He's left $2 million this year and $2 million next year. So that allows you to make more. Like if you're a team that's going for the Stanley Cup, and the one that I keep coming back to, the Pittsburgh Penguins, they could still win the Cup this year. Can they win it with this defense? I don't know. But Jacob Trouba makes that defense a hell of a lot better.
See, that's where I think I think you're right.
You still have room to move because
yeah.
you've got him under market value.
Where you're rightest is the idea that you've with the bridge deal and with that cap hit, you may have now opened the door for him to go to a more of a contender.
Totally.
You might have teams that are a lot closer to a cup looking at that contract and saying we can fit that now.
And
devil may care what happens in 2 years.
He could go from not playing, you know, being that pouty hockey player mm-hmm. to winning a Stanley Cup. And in 2 years, Pittsburgh could have Stanley Cup rings for Justin Schultz, Phil Kessel, and Jacob Trouba.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Just awesome.
That's so funny. All right. We got a lot to talk about. We should also probably touch on the Hall of Fame because I don't know if we're going to do another one of these before the weekend. And Dan Murphy coming up. So
I
with that,
that,
producer yeah. Sam, let's start the show proper, shall we?
Jeff Merrick of Sportsnet.
So there has to be a standard version of red and blue. What is the actual shade of colors of the red and blue lines in the NHL?
Yeah.
Greg Wyshynski of Yahoo Sports.
Why don't they sell that specific shade labeled blue line blue
Ooh,
and red line red
blue.
For hockey fans?
Debate hockey, pop culture, and more hockey. Merrick versus Wyshynski.
There are so many colors in the
As we do this show, this show will be out before we know the election results tonight. I hope everybody, all my friends in the U.S. voted.
Hang on, everybody listening right now, all my friends in the United States, we'll leave the back door open here at the homestead. The barn door will be open as well. We'll leave a light on in the back if you need somewhere to stay tonight. If you need to get out fast, know you have a friend
get out
up
while
here
you,
with some,
while you
some property.
Yeah,
you've been up here, Wish. You know we have some room. We got some room here. People need to crash.
That's funny. I had my car worked on yesterday, and I was talking to this mechanic. They're based right by the Javits Center, where Hillary is going to have what will hopefully be a victory celebration tonight. And he was talking about how, like, you know, there's going to be fireworks and this whole thing and whatever. And, you know, he's talking about how he lives in Harlem, and he imagines it's going to be a big celebration there, too, if things break the Democrats' way. And he's like, and if it doesn't, man, I don't know. Might just fly to the Philippines, hang out there for a while. I'm like, well, here's the great thing for me. I'm like, I'm a hockey writer. I can't tell you how many couches I've been offered in the last calendar year to just crash on until this all blows over.
Standing offer. You can take, you know, where the spare room is in the place right by the kitchen over there. I wish you help yourself to the fridge. There's beer in the back fridge by the mud room. Like, go for it, man. Just help yourself. You know where the smoky is. Just leave a little something for your buddy Jeff.
I don't need to make the case which way or the other you should vote. I'm sure you've got reasons if you're voting for Trump. That's fine. I vehemently disagree with you and find this to be an untenable position, but that's fine if you do. I mean, I think it's probably more about your feelings about her than it is about him. I will say that as a guy who does deal with a lot of people from around the world, explaining this one has been tough. Like, when I was at the World Cup talking to people from other countries about U.S. politics, not only explaining the tone and tenor of the campaign, but explaining Trump has been tough. And I imagine if he wins, it's just going to get tougher.
I'm going to have a hard time with a couple of things here, Greg. I thought about this a couple of years ago as well. Eventually, I'm going to have to tell my children about two political phenomenons, one Donald Trump and the other Rob Ford. Like, eventually my kids are going to be old enough to say, hey, what the fuck was that Rob Ford stuff all about? And they're going to say the same thing about Donald Trump. And I don't know how the hell I'm going to explain it to them. Wish, I really don't. I have no clue.
David Fahrenholz, a writer for the Washington Post, I want to say it is. I think he writes for the Post. And the most the coverage of this election has been all over the place. And you know, I'm not trying to downplay the emails thing or downplay any of it. But the one thing that I can't believe didn't get more play was the work that David Fahrenholz did about Trump and charities, where he went and he tracked down every charity that Donald Trump claimed that he gave money to. Tens of millions of dollars, he said. And he called them all. These are charities that he claimed he gave to between January 1st, 2009, and May 23rd, 2016. He called them all for 6 months and found one example in which Trump actually gave money. And the whole thing for me is, like, if you want to vote for Trump for whatever reason, party affiliation, you hate Hillary, whatever, but, like, you've got to be able to stand there and say that the one thing this guy is running on, which is his financial acumen and his generosity, has been completely unsubstantiated because he hasn't released his tax return and he hasn't given but jack and shit to charity. So explain to me why you're voting for him.
Because I don't think anyone really cares about the truth anymore. I think people just care about their feelings. Honestly, this is one that's being led by the heart, not by the head.
Do you ever find it interesting that
But that's about everything, though. That's not just unique to the political process. It's just sort of caught up. I mean, this is something the Republicans started 50 years ago.
Yeah.
It's hit its zenith now with Donald Trump. Sorry if you're a Republican, but
one of the most disappointing aspects of this campaign has been the media coverage and the fact that CNN has basically devolved into an ESPN sports show by having different sides on. And it's not even about exploring issues. It's just about, you know, got to hear both sides. And then you have these uniquely unqualified people to support Trump because no one who is qualified is supporting Trump. And it's just devolved into nonsense. And I was wondering about that with hockey. Like, shout shows don't really exist in hockey, do they? And is that a Canadian thing?
Shout shows. No, they don't really.
You see stove or whatever.
Yeah, but not really.
Yelling.
No, you know what hockey's always been? Hockey hasn't been shouting. Hockey's been hand-wringing. Hockey's being anxiety. Hockey is in this, as far as the discussion goes, specifically in Canada. You could talk more about it in the United States. But in Canada, there's always this anxiety that there is something to be fixed, something to be worried over. This country is a collection of Marge Simpsons worrying about this game nonstop since the first time a rubber puck was introduced to cold ice. I guess all ice is cold. To frozen water. How about that? That's what it's always been. It's always been in this perpetual state of needing fixing. It's anxiety. It's nervousness. That's the conversation around hockey. It's hand-wringing. That's what it is. It's not shouting. It's not shouting about it.
I think that if there was more shouting in the States, people would care more about hockey, to be honest with you. Like,
you think so?
That's the sad part about it, is that is the language of consumption now. Is shouting at each other. Shouting at each other about politics. Shouting at each other about LeBron or Tebow. That's why Fox Sports 1's trying to make inroads on ESPN. It's adopted the entire model that ESPN had, which is hire Skip Bayless and hire Colin Cowherd and have shows where people just shout at each other. But on the NHL coverage here in the States, if there is any shouting, it feels really manufactured and dumb. It feels like, well, all right, I'm taking this side of the argument now.
I wonder how much of that is so much of the game. Do you find this in the United States? I mean, in Canada, there are certain assumptions you can make about the game, and then you just move on with the conversation. In the United States, do you find that a lot of the conversation, because I see it on the national broadcast all the time, is more about still trying to teach the audience what the game is all about and what is actually happening in this game, because it's not on par with baseball, where everyone understands.
Oh,
it's not on par with football,
without
where everyone
question.
Understands it.
There's
still like
question.
This educate. This it's like, okay, class is in session. Professor Emmerich now will tell you about hockey for 2 hours.
And it's one of the disagreements I've had with Sam Flood from NBC before, when we've talked about the coverage, is who do you think is watching, you know, Lightning Devils on a Tuesday night on NBC. It's not like the guy flipping around. He's like, I don't know. Should I watch Indiana Jones on Last Crusade again on USA Network? Or should I watch this hockey game? No, it's a guy. It's people that actually care about the hockey game they're watching. So you don't need to dumb it down at all for your audience, because the audience is already educated about hockey. That's why they're watching it.
Let me give you a peek inside a programmer's brain. If you're looking to widen your base, widen your viewership, you say to yourself, we're always going to have the hardcores. I'm just telling you, this is how the mainstream programs things. We don't worry about the hardcores. They are there. There is no need to super serve them. They are going nowhere. The key is to try to get more people under the tent. That's why the nature, I'm not saying it's right, I'm just saying this is how they think. The nature of the conversation needs to be dumbed down to a more base level to get more people under this hockey tent. Don't worry about what they call P1s, your core audience. They are already there, and they aren't going anywhere. No need to super serve them.
And here's the bottom line about the election vis-a-vis the NHL, by the way, to bring it full circle. I could give a shit about what these guys think of the election, these players, unless they're politically active. Apparently, I think Thomas Grice has, like, put up a bunch of, like, pro-Trump stuff on his Facebook. If you wanted to ask him about that, that'd be fair game. If you wanted to ask Tom Brady or Bill Belichick about supporting Trump in a public manner, that's fair game. But, like, I see these stories of like, reporters going to the locker room being like, hey, guys, what do you think of the election? And at the end of the day, I don't care. And, B, the only thing that's going to happen is that someone's bound to say something stupid and uninformed.
Yeah, I know. Like, if you put yourself out there as someone who invites those types of questions and wants to be part of that conversation, then have at them.
The only time
but just
I've
going
ever
up
done
to
it.
Some, just going up to some nervous rookie on the New Jersey Devils and sticking a microphone in their face and asking them about, you know, Hillary, the emails, and the FBI.
Yeah,
like,
right.
We're playing Carolina tomorrow. We're talking about... You know, can we talk about what happens if Justin Falk's still injured?
Pavel Zacha, what did you think of the Comey letters? But the only time I've ever done it was I interviewed a Gindler once when Obama was up the first time in 08. Flames were in D.C. They're playing the Capitals, and I asked him about the election. He gave me a very beautiful answer about the opportunity and seeing someone break the color barrier for the presidency and all that stuff. Like, there are ways to approach it, but just like, hey, what do you think about Trump and Hillary, huh? It's just like, I don't give a shit about what they think about it.
You know who my new favorite reporter is? just based on one question. Ryan Whitney.
Ryan Whitney's so, great, isn't he?
Yeah. Ryan Whitney is doing ringside for BU games. So he's doing the game, I think it was Saturday against Northeastern, they won 3-0. And he's interviewing Tom Kelly of BU. And he texts me, like, how'd it go? He goes, well, I was super nervous. And my first question was, what's up? to Tom Kelly. Which, you know what? Fuck, if I'm watching that, God, I'm loving it. Like, yeah. Honestly, aren't you just loving it if it's like, oh my God, Ryan Whitney, ex-NHLer, is interviewing Tom Kelly of BU, and his first question sticks a microphone in his face and says, so Tom, what's up?
Yeah.
So refreshingly different.
And I agree. Cause honestly, and I'm, you know, I'll claim some kinship here with Whitney. Most of the time when I sit down with a dude or I'm talking to somebody post game, and this is maybe not the best question to ask, but my first question will be like, so what do you think? You know, just put it out there. What do you think?
Just go away. So what do you think? Say something.
Well, what do you think about that? I saw there was a slight gyration of the puck before you shot it on your second goal.
No. What do you think? Tell me what you think. Yeah. See, what's life like for you? What do you think? What do you think about these Canucks before Murph comes on? What are your thoughts on this team right now? I think it's just a giant course correction.
He's there.
Well, let's get Murph's thoughts on it. Dan Murphy joins us from Sportsnet, covering the Vancouver Canucks specifically. Murph, how are you today, and how did you fare with Wish yesterday?
I think we did pretty well. We managed to keep the Vancouver hate to a minimum, and that's tough these days. There's a lot of angst coming out of Vancouver. But we might be lucky that most people were still in their cars driving home, being an East Coast game. So
I also think that you know they probably saw that I was a jovial sort, and they said, "Well, he's not all that half bad." I also feel you know, as per usual, like the question was that Murph put to me was like, "Who should be more worried about Louis Erickson or Andrew Ladd?" As far as like free agent busts, I'm like, oh, definitely Ladd. So of course he scores, and of course. Louis screws up. So of course that all happens.
Yeah, yeah.
But
yeah.
We won't be having Greg on again tonight.
It's Canucks and the Rangers. Here we go, MSG. Well, we're trying to sort of play pin the tail on the donkey here, and sort of get to, you know, what has happened here with the Vancouver Canucks. And I've been, I think, consistent with this for a number of years, that a season like this has been a long time coming. If we go back and you have a look at the draft, and you go back and, you know, even go back to, I guess we'll cut it off at 2005, you know, the unfortunate situation with Luc Bourdon passing away. He still would have been playing and playing significant minutes in the NHL. But if you go back to 2005 draft up until right now, it is, to be generous, Murph, underwhelming. And if you miss on a first-round pick, it sets your franchise back two seasons. I mean, this is an organization that's whiffed on not just their first-rounder, but, you know, the second-rounder and all the way down. There are some draft years, you know, when I look at 2010, you know, Alex Friesen playing one game, and that's it from the entire draft class. Has this not sort of been, you know, a collapse in the making for a number of years now?
Yeah, I mean, the drafting has been poor, I think, until probably just recent years.
Yep.
And that won't come into fruition for quite some time. And then that's also due to the fact they've been drafting higher the last years than they did back in the mid-2000s to 2010. So there's no question that's been a big problem for Vancouver. And, you know, I think the problem is that, you know, first year under Desjardins, they had, 101 points, went to the playoffs. Last year, they had 75. And I think that, you know, I'm not sure if they believe it, but I think they probably felt they were more close to the first year under Willie Desjardins than last year, when really that's not the case. And I think most people see that this club needs to bottom out. It needs to go scorched earth. It needs to figure it out. They're stuck, though, with the Twins, though, for another year,
yep.
Right? Not many teams can take on $14 million if you're going to trade them both together. So they're kind of in a rock and a hard spot, and I think it's tough to say. It could get worse before it gets better. But I mean, it was a team that finished third last year and, you know, unfortunately dropped two spots in the draft lottery, went the wrong way. And there's just not a lot of reason to believe that this could get turned around in a hurry. I mean, Brock Besser is in North Dakota. Thatcher Demko is a first year pro in Utica. And then what else is there to really look forward to at this point if you're a Vancouver Canucks fan? Jake Virtanen is going to be a healthy scratch again. Tonight, the second consecutive game, he's a sixth overall pick. McCann went in the first round that same year. He was traded for Goodbranson. So you know, some of these first rounders they took aren't around anymore, and those are the promising ones. I mean, McCann has to be considered still a good prospect. Corey Schneider was a first round pick. He's no longer around. So some of the ones that did work out as players are no longer with the club.
Can we pause on Jake Virtanen for 1 second? I had a conversation with someone a while ago about Virtanen, and listen, when it comes around to Jake Virtanen, the caveat has always been the shot. I mean, that guy has a gun, he's got a bullet. And someone I was talking to brought up an interesting point who said, you know what, he has a great junior hockey shot, but it won't translate to the NHL. And I said, what do you mean by that? He said, in junior hockey, he could blow the puck by goaltenders. It was that heavy a shot, that hard a shot. If you're not accurate now in the NHL, like, no one's blowing a shot by a goalie anymore. It's not happening. You need to be pinpoint accurate with your shot. Is Jake Virtanen there? And if not, is that what's holding him back, Murph?
Well, I'm going to give you my take, and I was just trying to think of a way to do it in two or three tweets or less. But he's getting scratched today. I think he's still got the skills. He's big. He can skate well. Mm-hmm. He does have a great shot, a great release. But when he's playing in Vancouver, he's playing 8 minutes a game if he's playing at all. And I asked Desjardins today about him, and he said he's got to be more consistent with the minutes that he gets. And I said, well, is that a chicken or the egg thing? How can he get consistent if he's not playing? And he said, well, he's just got to, when he gets his chance, he's got to make the most of it. And he brought up Nikita Trampkin, and who was scratched for, I don't know, the first 7-8 games of the season. So I'm reading between the lines there thinking that Trampkin got better even without playing. And so maybe the coach doesn't think that Virtanen is putting in the work on days that he's not playing, putting in the work at practice, not doing enough to be ready to play when he gets that chance. This is my theory. So maybe he hasn't learned enough to be a consistent pro, and I think probably the best spot for him to do that is in Utica. Now, again, a coach does not have to be in on a rebuild. A coach is going to make the decisions he thinks is going to win games now, unless otherwise instructed by the GM. So, obviously, right now, the coach doesn't think that Virtanen is going to help him win games, and it's not his job at this point to worry about development. That's my
theory. At what point in this season do you think they start shedding players, or will that happen after the season if things don't go well?
Well, you know, if I think the smart thing to do would be to shed as many as you can right now. And a trade for draft picks. The problem is that, I think I read somewhere that Denning, who, you know, is a former scout, drafting is probably his strong point, has traded away more draft picks than Mike Gillis. And Mike Gillis had a good team. So that's a bit of a problem. So maybe ownership wanted a quick turnaround. I don't think it's possible. I think everybody realizes that they should trade away players, bring in draft picks, bring in players under 24 years of age, but maybe there is a directive from ownership they don't want to go scorched earth. This has never been said, but I have to believe that's probably the case.
Is it not impossible to do so for the reason you brought up initially, Murph, which is as long as the Sedins are there, and that's your first line pair, depending on, you know, who's on the right side as well, as long as they're there, how can you?
Well, I mean, I think when you realize that even with them there, you're not going to have any shot at making a run in the playoffs, then I think you still do what's best for the overall health of the organization moving forward. I think they really wanted to believe that signing, I think they were looking at next year as the year to kind of get back to the playoffs and hopefully make a run for the Twins last year under contract. And maybe that's why they did the Erickson sign. Maybe that's why they tried to get Lucic, who was never going to sign in Vancouver, by the way. I think they were thinking ahead to next year and having one more run for the Twins. I think that this season will probably tell them that's not possible, and then they can maybe reassess where they are as an organization. Or maybe they're doing that right now, too, because, you know, it, in short order here, they're going to be just about as far out as you can be after a month of play. And I think they're, you know, the realization is going to hit them squarely in the face if it hasn't already.
Yeah, the Erickson thing's interesting because, I thought it was a good signing only because I thought the chemistry with the Sedins would be there. It's not there quite yet. I think he's a good dude.
But wasn't the World Cup, though. That's a weird thing.
Yeah, the more you see it, though, and you see the trajectory of this team, the more you hear those complaints when they signed him, which was, why do you need him if you're going to be kind of in a rebuild for the next few years?
Yeah, well, I think that's a totally, totally valid point. And I think, once again, it comes down to maybe misreading just how competitive they're going to be. because I don't think it was the right time to sign an older guy to a six-year deal to $6 million per year, unless, again, ownership wants players to try to sell tickets around. And sometimes the hardcore fans are not the ones buying tickets, the expensive seats, so maybe they needed a new player to trot out. But when you think of last year, 75 points, what has this team done? Essentially swapped Erickson for Verbata, right? And then they swapped Goodbranson for Ham Hughes. That's it. You know, and the team couldn't score last year. I'm not sure how they thought they were going to score a ton more this year, unless it was, you always heard that, well, the if, and if they still stay healthy. Well, already they've been crushed by injuries to some of the best players. It was never going to be that way, so.
The tan of injury crushes them. That's a real killer, Murph. Hey, you know, off the Vancouver Canucks page and sort of more into the, we were just talking about ringside reporting before you came on, and we were talking about Ryan Whitney, who was, you know, gold at the BU game on the weekend, asking Tom Kelly, what's up, as his first question as he comes off the comes off the ice after the second period, which is a great opener. When you're doing ringside and a player comes off, like yesterday with Daniel Sedin, you closed with the Kadri question, which you had to ask, and he gave you, I think it was like, well, it's in the past, I don't want to talk about it and answer, but you have to do it. When you go into, take a sort of behind, you know, your thought process, player X from the Vancouver Canucks, Bo Horvat, Daniel Sedin, whomever, Lucas Biza, comes off the ice, what are you looking to get out of them in that tiny little window that you have to do so?
Well, I mean, I try to, I mean, because it's just, sometimes you're in a no-win situation. You know, nobody likes the ringside reporter interviews. They don't feel they get anything out of them. But I try. It's true, but I try to sometimes, like Spiza the other day, he was paired with Trampkin. So I'm like, I wanted to ask him, I know that you speak five languages, Russian isn't one. So how are you communicating out there? Something maybe that the viewer might be thinking they want an answer to. You know, sometimes it's impossible. Like yesterday, I was hustling, you know, Wyshynski can tell you, but the rooms at the Barclays Center are at either end of the rink. So it's 2-1 Islanders. I'm running down to go get, I think, Hickey. And as I'm in the bowels, I hear that, you know, Granlund scores. So I go back and I get set up for the Canucks and they send out Granlund. I haven't seen the goal yet. So I really want to say, can you describe the goal and really describe it? Because I haven't seen it, you know. So sometimes you're in a no-win situation, but I always try to come up with a little something that maybe I've read or something different. But the other problem with that is a lot of times that PR wants it to be game-driven.
Totally.
So sometimes you might even get a PR staff that have been mad at me last night for asking Daniel that question during a game. Now, I never heard anything about it from the Canucks, but sometimes you need to ask those questions because he hadn't spoken on camera really about it, except for maybe to Canucks TV. So that's what I try to do. And if you can bring some humor to it or something a little different, that's the only thing I think you can do in those situations when you have 90 seconds.
You know what, Murph? I remember the first time I did ringside, Hockey Night in Canada, December 29, 2007, was an Ottawa-Washington game. I know. Well, it was my first shot on Hockey Night, right? And one of the walk-offs was Jason Spezza. And this is right around the time where Ray Emery was missing practices and broken alarm clock and getting suspended by the team and all that drama. And so I did two questions in about the period with Spezza. And then one, I asked him a question about Ray Emery. And he kind of said, well, you know, Ray Emery's a member of our team. We support him. It's standard answer. You're going to get it out of any veteran player. He's not going to be tricked into giving you anything good. And as he walked off, I threw it back to Ron McLean. And the person who handled media relations at that point just proceeded to tear a strip off of me, like up and down the wall. Have you had an experience that bad, Murph? Because that was like, I'm like, really, guy? Like, I can't ask him about the issue of the day. You ever have anyone that bad, Murph?
No, I've never had a PR staff chew me out. Sometimes, like, they'll say, you're not going to, like, you know, I had last year Jack Johnson. And I'm not going to ask him, obviously, about his parents, but the PR staff said, you better not ask anything about the financial situation. I was like, I wasn't going there. You know, so sometimes you get warnings, right? But I've never had really someone, one time, and this was not even ringside, I was sitting down Rick Nash when he was with Columbus for something, and just as the camera's getting set up, I was making casual conversation about, you know, where, you know, guys get up to anything or anything. And I think at the time, after he talked to Todd Chirac, who's been with the Blue Jackets forever, wondering if I was mining for information if the guys were out at the Roxy or something. So Sharon.
Oh, really?
Said, wait, well, yeah, and I wasn't. I was making conversation. I was not going with anything in that. So, I mean, that once that got cleared up quickly, but Todd came to ask me about it. But, you know, I think they know sometimes when a question has to be asked. And I've had situations where they say, yeah, you can get this guy, but don't ask him about this, about something you clearly have to ask about. And I'm like, well, I'm going to ask the question. If he wants to say no comment, he can't. Because sometimes it's your duty to ask the question no matter what.
Okay, let me. I'm sorry, I'm hogging this one, Wish, but I'm fascinated by.
No, go ahead.
And this, because I've always, there's favorite guys that you always want to talk to. And one of the guys that I always had more respect for than anybody else, who always came out, always answered the media, never said no, was always gracious, there after a win, there after a loss, there after the game, was Matt Stajan. And he's still that guy to this day. Do you have a Matt Stajan in your career, one that you know you can always go to no matter what, and he'll always do the interview?
Well, I mean, I think probably prior to a couple years ago, BX would have been the guy.
Thought so.
Always willing to give you something different, you know, whether it's humorous or a good answer or, you know, not afraid to be a little controversial. You were always guaranteed to get something. The Twins will never hide from anything. If it's going awful and off the rails, you can always go to them, but they might not give you anything good. I'll tell you a guy now that's quickly becoming a go-to guy is Yannick Hansen. Always thoughtful with his answers, always very well read. The other day, you know, sometimes guys surprise you. And I forget which game it was after, but they were trailing, as usual, and they piled up some shots and had some chances. I think it was against the Oilers. And so I asked him after, and he goes, well, of course we piled up shots. I mean, we're down a goal. We're pressing. They're sitting back. They're just, you know, he brought up score effects, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you're just like, okay, so some guys do want to give you, you know, a good answer. When you're giving them an out to take, you know, a compliment, and he basically turned in to say, well, we shouldn't be complimented on that because really we're pressing for a goal. It always happens.
Score effects, yeah. That's fascinating. That's great.
Murph, you're a gentleman and a scholar. Thank you for joining us and enlightening us about all things Canuck and all things sideline reporter.
All things ringside. Yeah, enjoy MSG.
I'm just going to say, I'm really surprised that last night I pinned the poppy on Wyshynski, and I can't believe that the guys in the truck didn't get that out somehow. It's like a guy with his grad date putting on the.
That's what I said. I said, treat me like your prom date, and he pinned it on me.
Put a poppy on you. Hey, listen,
I've talked about the poppies on this show before. Like, I think the poppies are ingenious for one reason, which is that they're so shabbily put together that you end up giving charity even more money.
Yes, that's
over
strategy.
Time.
Yes,
as
correct.
They fall apart. What an ingenious! It's
kind of
like how they want to make the perfect car, but not the perfect car because then you
right.
buy another one.
God bless the legions from coast to coast here in this country. Hey Murph, enjoy your what's probably going to be your last time at Joe Louis, I would imagine, on Thursday night.
Yes, I mean, I've done a lot of games in that building. I'll just quickly say there was the 0-2 of the year they won the Cup. Canucks played a series in there in the first round, went 6. Then I did the Cup final there that started there, so I did 3 more games there. Then a week later, I did the Canadian Seniors in Windsor. So I spent way too much in that part of the world in that 2-month stretch.
Awesome.
There you go.
Well, enjoy. Yeah. Thanks for doing this, Dan.
All right, boys. Have a good day.
There he is, Dan Murphy. Excellent ringside host, analyst, reporter, however you want to describe it.
Jacob Trouba tells Ken Weeb today of the Winnipeg Sun that he's committed to sign with Winnipeg. When I signed that piece of paper, everything changed my mind. He doesn't want to be traded anymore, is what he says. I think that's just public smoke. I think
Write that down. Pin that up. Pin that tweet. Mm-hmm. Pin that tweet. Let's see what happens.
If so,
then the follow-up question should be, well, are you pissed off your agent for leaving $4 million on the table then?
Like, what changed? Nothing changed. It's a little bit of BS. Jacob Trouba Moore. All right, here we go. Ready? This is from Ken Weeby. Ready?
Yeah.
I'm part of this team, and whatever I'm asked to do for these next two years I'm under contract is what I'm going to do. This was never about Winnipeg. I tried making that very clear, and knew people were going to make their own opinions. Are you out of your mind? Of course it's about Winnipeg. Come on, man. You wanted to be emancipated.
I will not stand in the way of Kevin Cheveldayoff trading me. I am so committed to the Winnipeg Jets, and if that's what they think is in the Winnipeg Jets' best interest, I will not stand in their way.
That's right. No, he's committed now. It's 2 years. All right.
Okay.
We'll see. Real quick on the Hall of Fame.
Were you born at night, by the way?
What?
Were you born at night or in the morning?
I was not.
Oh, okay. Were you born last night?
I was born at 10:32 in the morning. Patricia Wyszynski. Hall of Fame, obviously, I'm a happy boy. Lindros is in. Long time coming. Once Pavel Bure got in, you kind of had a feeling that it was going to be all right.
That chummed the waters for the stats.
Yep.
Yes.
And so he gets in. He kissed the right asses, made the right amends, and Eric Lindros to the Hall of Fame.
I don't know if it was a matter of Eric Lindros, puckering up. I just think that it was going to be too embarrassing for the Hall of Fame long haul not to have him in there. It became more embarrassing each and every year.
All right.
That's how I feel about it.
I think his work, he's done a lot of laying down some groundwork to make people feel better about him, because I think he knew he was kind of a prick when he played. Made amends with the Flyers,
made amends with some NHLPA work. Listen, there are plenty of a-holes that are in the Hall of Fame. And there are a lot of guys that were, that were that way when they played. And then, they have the, sobering second look at their career, and they realize, man, if I would do it again, I would have been a different guy.
Mm-hmm.
And they're different because of it. But this isn't the, Hockey Hall of Nice Guy fame.
Yeah.
It's Hockey Hall of Fame. Lindros belongs there.
And a few words from you about Rogie Vachon making the Hall of Fame.
There were always two goalies, Lauren Chabot and Rogie Vachon, that I banged the drum for, knowing full well that probably both would never get in. And I still don't think that Lauren Chabot will get in, because no one who's in the voting committee is old enough to have seen Lauren Chabot play. So unless someone is interested in historical oversight, I don't think Lauren Chabot's ever getting in. Rogie was one of my favorites. This one to me is, the numbers are there for Rogie, but for me it was always, he was one of the first goalies I ever identified with. His performance at the Canada Cup 1976 is one of the singular most wonderful goaltending performances I've ever seen in my life. He played on a really bad LA Kings team for a lot of years and was the bright spot there. I know I gush about Rogie Vachon a ton on this podcast, but I'm thrilled that Rogie finally finds his rightful place in the Hall, because listen, as he said too, this isn't like, okay, yeah, he's Bernie Perrant, he's going in, he's Ken Dryden, he's going in, he's Tony Esposito, he's Patrick Waugh, he's going in. No, he's Rogie Vachon. He was almost one of those forgotten guys of what was an era of some pretty fantastic goaltending. When you look at Bernie Perrant, look at Ken Dryden and Tony Esposito in the 70s, I'll put Rogie Vachon in there with all those guys any day of the week. So I'm thrilled that he's going in.
There you go. Lovely. And obviously.
And one of the great small goalies of all time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's long overdue. It was a good year for overdue guys.
Yeah, it really was.
This year for the Hall.
It really was. Lindros, I'm super happy about him. I'm happy he's in. I think he epitomizes a facet of the Hall of Fame that sometimes can get overlooked, which is the flame that burned too bright. I think sometimes they can be all about longevity, although not in Dave Andrejuk's case, and overlook guys that actually did make the kind of impact that Lindros did. But
the peak performer, right? But that's one of the questions that guys always ask. How long did you play in the game?
Mm-hmm.
How many years did you play? Oh, wow. Man, Steve Ott just played 800 games. But 2 weeks ago, Steve Ott just played his 800th game. Yeah. And if you saw him coming out of Windsor and starting in the NHL, you said to yourself, this guy's going to play 800 games? Probably not. But there's a lot of respect that players give to guys that have played that long. Regardless of contribution, if you've been in the game that long, you have respect from just about everyone around the NHL.
Yeah.
That's why I still think they pin longevity as being one of the big hallmarks when it comes to voting.
Absolutely.
All those guys think it's a big deal.
Like, for example,
as opposed to just peak performer for 6 years.
Yep. For example, Jay Bouwmeester just passed 1,000 NHL games. Can you name one?
Can you name one game? Wow, has there been a better laid-back defenseman than Jay Bouwmeester?
Smooth.
Like, when you watch him, you're just like, he's just out for a skate. He's an amazing skater, one of the best of this generation, and he's just out there. Like, hockey is just awesome. Hockey's great. I'm going to have a nice skate. Jay Bowman, look how good my stride is.
I would accuse him of being a Westworld robot, except those robots are programmed to have some modicum of personality to trick people into thinking they're real. Maybe he was a prototype. I don't know, but
could be. Right, you gotta hustle. I got a conference call to go. I want to do my yearly, you know, bitching and moaning about the Foster Hewitt. And this is no disrespect to Sam Rosen, and congratulations, and he's well-deserving. Sam Rosen is well-deserving of the Foster Hewitt. Yet, once again, this is only an award, much like the Selke has evolved into an award only centers can win. The Foster Hewitt is only an award, this is the Broadcaster's Award, folks, that people that work in either the play-by-play or color capacity will ever make in. I don't know if it's too much of the influence of Chuck Caton or Mike Emmerich, but there is an award that celebrates broadcasting excellence and contributions to the game, yet it is one that does not have Dave Hodge, Ward Cornell, Ron McLean, or Don Cherry. Their common denominator, they do studio work, which to that voting group of broadcasters apparently contributes nothing, or if anything, very little to the broadcast. Ward Cornell, Dave Hodge, Ron McLean, Don Cherry, not in the Hall of Fame by way of the Foster Hewitt Award.
Go look at the list.
How many studio guys do you see? It is embarrassing.
Exactly. And when the time comes for them to hand out the first James Myrtle Award for excellence in hockey blogging, I just hope to be considered. I would love to be a Hall of Fame. I would make the Hall of Fame so great, you wouldn't believe how great it will be.
Okay, Donald. Okay.
I will have a Big Lee plaque. It will be so great you couldn't even imagine how great it will be.
I'm going now, Donald Wyszynski.
By the way, if you haven't seen it, and you probably have seen it by the time this hits, the screen grab of Donald Trump staring over the blinder
to make sure his wife's voting for him,
Melania's ballot to make sure she's voting for him, is the same.
Spectacular.
There's been a lot of like this campaign was worth it for X moment. That might be it for me. The guy who can't even trust his wife to have voted for him is phenomenal. All right, thanks to Sam for grabbing Murph on the fly. Thanks to everybody for listening. I guess next week. I'm getting married on Friday, by the way.
I know. This is a big deal.
It's a very big deal. Love Ruby. She's the best.
She's awesome.
And, thank you. And it's going to be super fun. And so the rest of the week is, in the words of the great Jeff Merrick, pooched for me.
Pooched.
So we'll be back next week for more podcasting fun. All right, everybody. Bye. Thank you.